I'm going to call the meeting to order, and those representatives who are here get extra points for their prompt presence. We're going to have a number of presentations today. One of the first ones is a presentation by Homes for All, which some of you may know some of the folks from the different organizations that we'll be hearing from. And then we're going to have an overview of housing initiatives from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, another one of the parts of state government where there are housing issues. So, first of all, we have the minutes to... Well, actually, we don't have a quorum, so we're going to wait on that. And as soon as we get a quorum, we'll approve the minutes, and we're going to start today with temporarily without a quorum. So the first folks who are coming today are from Homes for All, and I have a list of about three people, I guess. So please come on forward. Liz Coppola first, I believe. And team, I think. Oh, it's all three of you. Okay, great. Welcome to the committee, and each of you, as you speak with us, if you introduce yourselves.
Between mics.
There you go.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for inviting us to be here. My name is Darielle Dannon, and I work at the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers. We're a membership organization. We have almost 50 members. Our members do community development, so the housing portion of that is they do pretty much every part of housing. So they develop affordable rental housing, provide opportunities for those transitioning out of homelessness, provide homeownership opportunities, foreclosure prevention counseling, and do foreclosure recovery work. And one of our members has been so good to join us today, so she'll be talking in just a few minutes, but this is, I'll let her introduce herself.
You do a quick introduction. I'm Lee Blanz. I'm the Executive Director of Portico Interfaith Housing Collaborative.
Welcome to the committee.
And sorry, I didn't mention. So I'm also, along with Liz Coppola here, I'm one of the co-chairs of the Homes for All Alliance. So Liz is going to tell you a little bit more.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Liz Coppola. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We're a statewide coalition of over 150 homeless service providers. Like Darielle mentioned, I'm also co-chair of the Homes for All Alliance. The Homes for All is a collection of 40 groups like ours, hers and mine, and Portico, and others who really understand that to tackle homelessness, we have to tackle housing and homelessness together and move forward. We worked together with many of you last year on a bonding bill, and so we're just here to talk about the full comprehensive agenda on housing and homelessness.
Great. So I think we're going to turn it over at Portico so they can do sort of a little on-the-ground kind of what things are looking like from a sort of development standpoint, and then we're going to talk a little bit about sort of the need on the homeless from the homeless standpoint.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to share our experience. We are a nonprofit housing developer in the Twin Cities area. We currently provide 400 apartments that are affordable to people who are low income and very low income, often coming out of homelessness. One of the things I'd like to share is just a slightly from the bigger perspective of what's happening out in our communities. You may hear from your own constituents that the rental vacancy rate is very low. It's very difficult, regardless of income, to find a good quality apartment in our community. We have a vacancy rate which is down to 2.7%, and it's even lower, of course, for very low-income people. Just from our own personal experience, we opened Creekside Commons in southwest Minneapolis, family housing for 30 families. Just 2 years ago, we within the first month as we leased up, 300 families came onto our waiting list for those 30 apartments. We also know that as we look across, that for very low-income people, only 35 of those families can, out of 100, can find the quality, affordable housing that people need in our community.
Thank you so much.
Over the last 10 years, rents have continued to rise while the incomes of low-income people in our community have fallen. So rents have gone up 6% and income has gone down 16%. So obviously we know that is what's creating the crisis in our community as we see homelessness rise. And one of the things that we really would love to communicate to you is that we know what works in the community. We have very effective programs, whether it's at Portico or my colleagues at other nonprofit housing organizations here in the cities and across the state. So we know how to bring capital dollars together. We know how to bring operating and rental assistance together. And for those that serve the homeless population, to add supportive services and employment programs to really transform lives. So we know how to do it. We have the technical know-how, but what we need are the resources to be able to make it happen. I'm proud to talk about Nicollet Square, which is one of our flagship developments in South Minneapolis. You have a picture of it being handed out. It opened just about 2 years ago And one of the things that's significant is that it was made possible because of the operating support and rental assistance made available to us through the state of Minnesota. It provides housing for 42 young people, mostly 18 and 19-year-olds, who were either homeless or aging out of foster care. And we are able to provide apartments at about $200 a month. And the balance is then provided through this rental assistance that allows us to take someone who's literally coming in off the streets and unemployed. We have an employment program that gets them employed within 2 weeks and then has them paying $200 a month rent while we then work with them. Most of them have come in under incredible challenges in terms of the childhoods they've experienced. We're able to provide the life skills, the trauma recovery, and then those really practical skills about being a tenant and in participating in our employment programs so that people are then able to move out of Nicollet Square and be able to afford rents in our community. So we just want to share how key that operating and rental assistance is to serving those very low-income people in our community. We as an organization, and of course along with my other nonprofit organizations, are ready to build more of this. We own land on University Avenue on the Central Corridor prior crossing to dream for 44 apartments here in Ramsey County to serve homeless young people. It's in the Alice Hausman's district. But one of the gaps is that same rental assistance and operating support that was available for Nicollet Square just 3 years ago is not available right now. And so we need the state resources to be able to replicate and take to scale the programs that we know work in our community. So I ask you for your support as we go forward to be able to meet the very, very basic need of a roof over young people's heads in our community.
It's okay with you to take questions as we go along?
Sure.
Is that all right?
Thank you.
Okay. That was Lee Blum and Representative Hertos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made the statement that rents are up 6%, incomes down 15%. Could you be more, I don't dispute the rents are up, could you be more clear on the demographic of that group that you're referring to, that the income is down 15%? Could you talk about, you know, how many people you're serving and what the income level is that was the barometer that measured that 15% decline?
Sure. Ms. Blunz.
Thank you. May I ask one of my colleagues?
Sure.
Thank you.
Yep. So that's actually a statewide.
Ms. Dana?
Sorry.
Okay. We just say your name
Madam
for the tape.
Chair, yep. That number is actually a statewide statistic. So it's from the American Community Survey, a census data. So both of those, that's something that they chart in the census. So it's all renters. So it's not just very low-income people. It's actually the entire state. One interesting thing that I think we'll be able to be sharing that have been recently put together by one of our colleagues is we've got some county-by-county information that we'll be able to share with members of the committee to really give you that picture of what's going on exactly in your community, too, with that information.
Great. Representative Hertos?
Thank you. Okay. Well, that'd be helpful because some of the other committees I'm serving on, there's income demographics, and they're claiming that Minnesota income is up a marginal amount of percentage. So I thought when you were referring to it being down 15%, you were maybe talking about the group that, you know, makes 20,000 and less or something of that nature. So thank you for that.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking at this building. This is a pretty impressive building. And as someone who is, well, first of all, how long did you say it was had been there?
Just over 2 years, years, Madam Chair.
Okay. And if from somebody outside the area, if I wanted to go see this, how would I get to it?
We have a tour on February 5th at 5 o'clock, and I would love to have you tour through. We would, I'll be glad to provide my contact information and arrange for a tour. We are very proud of what we've been able to create. I didn't even mention the retail in the picture is actually now full. So it's an amenity to the neighborhood as well as helping homeless young people. And so really from a community development point of view, it's a vacant funeral home on the corner. We tore it down, and I'd like to say we brought life back to that corner. And it now houses 42 young people. Thank you for laughing. And it now houses 42 young people, and three small businesses in the community are housed in that retail area, and some of our young people work in the Butter Bakery, which is now in that corner retail spot.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, Representative Green.
Madam Chair, what is the address of this?
It's 3700 Nicollet Avenue South in South Minneapolis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Who's next? Okay, continue on. Thank you. Oh, excuse me. While we're switching here, let's officially call the meeting to order. And I'd like to, I think Representative O'Neill's had a chance to look at the minutes. Would you like to move the approval of the minutes?
So moved.
Okay. The minutes have been moved to be approved. Any additions, corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those
aye.
In favor? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. Proceed, Ms. Daniel.
Thank you.
I have one question.
Sure, Representative Isaacson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just regarding the previous, I'm looking at the Homes for All legislation. What line item was what she was talking about on this? Is there one specific, or I just didn't catch that. Maybe you said it, so I apologize if I missed it.
Ms. Daniel?
Madam Chair, it's actually a couple of different line items, so I'm going to, if we were to look at the challenge fund that's on this line item here, that goes to build stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It also goes to provide funding for things like foreclosure recovery.
So
that's one of the areas. But then the housing trust fund, mm-hmm. that helps to pay for some of the services that that Lee was talking about.
Great.
As well as there are probably some DHS dollars in that building, and Lee can shake her head at me if I'm saying it. Okay, good. So it actually hits a couple of different places.
So it isn't just one spot that's doing that. It's a mixture to help put that together.
Yes, but I think that's a really good point, is that, and I think that's one of the things I actually wanted one of our developers to come and address the committee, because we have things in a budget that are in line items here, but it's good to remember that all of these things work together. And that was part of why, when you look at this Homes for All budget proposal, it's Minnesota Housing and DHS. And the reason is because we build stuff, and then we also have to keep providing those services so those families can succeed. I think that's a really important part of what's going on. And so to do that, we really need things to be working kind of hand in hand.
Representative Isaacson.
So just as I understand it, when we're looking at this, remember that if we're going to look at cutting or adding, we're really talking about dollars that are connected across funds. So that's important. That's a fair statement, correct?
Stanton?
All right.
Yes.
Okay, great.
That's a fair
Thank
statement.
You.
Thank you.
And I just want to really briefly talk about, and very briefly.
We have one more question.
Sorry.
Representative Radenovich.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. My question is probably along the lines of, you know, maybe what this building looks like, or what other newer, lower mixed-income housing looks like. I think that on the sheet here it talks about building community. Could you speak to how the design of these communities affects, you know, perhaps rates of crime, or, you know, achievement, or access to jobs and things like that?
Ms. Blunz?
Thank you. Thank you. Madam Chair, community design matters a lot, and I think that nonprofit housing developments, we really in Minnesota have a wonderful group of experienced developers that are able to work with neighbors and with the broader community, whether it's new construction as you see here, and to be able to revitalize a commercial corridor in the central city, or whether it's also renovating existing apartment buildings. I think any of those can be done as long as they're done in paying attention to the other architecture in the community. We had initially a design that was more modern. The neighborhood asked us to make it fit in more with brick, and so we were able to respond to those. Just a quick aside, the Neighborhood Association is actually holding a fundraiser for Nicollet Square next week. Mm-hmm. And to really imagine from a community developer point of view, for a neighborhood to welcome in housing for homeless young people into their neighborhood, and to not only allow it to happen, but to actually help sustain funding for it, is really a tremendous partnership that we've been able to create.
Madam Chair. So speaking towards a trend, you know, I think that perhaps some of us come in with the view or the idea that you know, brownstones sort of standing alone in a neighborhood, you know, concentrated low income or poverty housing, you know, is a model that's been used in the past. And could you sort of just speak to, you know, where we're at right now in the progress of the way we view these neighborhoods?
Response.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think that obviously every nonprofit housing organization may have their own feelings about this. From our perspective, it's really important that people have access to quality, affordable housing in a neighborhood of their choice. This is actually using HUD language, a non-impacted neighborhood. So it's really a middle-class neighborhood in Minneapolis. That we were able to then provide housing for young people who need jobs. And so to think that there are jobs not just in the building but down the street is important. Right. But we think that this kind of quality housing needs to be built in all neighborhoods so people can choose that neighborhood. I think there are lots of good variety for our experiences that different people need different kinds of housing. And so there's mixed income housing out there. And then there's housing like Nicollet Square where we're bringing 42 young people together who actually have similar concerns, and then being able to provide the supportive services right there that allow that community to be built within the building and then extended out into the neighborhood.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chairwoman. I just have a question about the population in this building. You said 42 young people, and I thought I heard you say something about coming out of foster care. Do you have the numbers as to how many are coming from the foster care system and how coming from other situations?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. For this particular building, it's roughly about 50 to 60% of our young people are long-term homeless, meaning most of them became homeless at the age of 14 or 15 or 16 and really work to stay invisible and then tend to surface at 18 and we're able to bring them into programs like Nicollet Square. And then just about 40% up to about 49% have come out of, have aged out of foster care, and we work closely with Hennepin County, and the young people are referred to us by Hennepin County, and then this provides that step from foster care parenting to independence, where they're responsible as a tenant for paying rent and working, and helps them transition more successfully. Statistically, across the country, according to the Annie Casey Foundation, 22% of young people aging out of foster care will become homeless within 1 year, and 42% will become homeless sometime in their life. So these kind of early interventions have really demonstrated a return on investment long-term as we help people complete their high school and GED.
Follow-up?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. And so do you have some success rates? I know this program is fairly new, but do you have some information for us as far as how successful this has been?
And I'm certainly glad to provide additional information. I'm just really off the top of my head. Right now, 95% of the young people at Nicollet Square are currently employed. And so we're very much an employment-focused program. Half the young people who came into Nicollet Square come in without high school or GED, despite the fact they're 18 or 19. And about, I believe about two-thirds have now completed that. And we have about 30 to 40% of our young people who came in with a high school diploma or have one now in post-secondary education, so really working on that vocational training to move them toward a livable wage. So we feel really good. It's a challenging population, and it doesn't work for everyone, so I don't want it to sound like a panacea, but we have very skilled staff. We partner with YouthLink and with Hired as the on-site service providers, and they really work to engage young people and try to keep them moving in the right path.
One last question.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. And so how, you know, this is obviously geared towards youth, and so when, do you have an age cap? And if so, then have you hit that point where you have people that are at that cap, and where do they go from there, and how successful have they been once they leave?
Ms. Plans.
Madam Chair, Representative. The way that Nicklick Square is designed is to have an age preference when young people are coming in, but it is designed, these are young people, whether they were homeless or in foster care, who often heard that they, where they got to stay, they didn't know if that would be forever. Mm-hmm. And although housing for young people, we don't expect people to stay until they're 70, this is actually designed that we don't impose a time limit. What we've done creatively, and once again it was made available because of the way the state funding came to us, flexible, the rent is $200 a month for the first 2 years, and then it moves to $300, and then in the fourth year it moves to $400. So we're creating incentives toward independence without just mandating that someone has to move out. We joke that we're a landlord that actually encourages people to put things up on the wall because our biggest challenge is the young people keep their stuff in a garbage bag. Sorry, I'll tear up. Because they're just ready to move on because that has been their life. And so we worked really hard to hold on to our young people and keep them in the apartments.
Thank you. Representative Radonovich?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, you know, in a lot of the presentations and testimony we've seen this year so far, there's a discussion of the benefit in terms of cost efficiency to have a program like this versus the alternatives for a population, you know, meeting this criteria. Could you speak to that and to what alternatives might be available to the population you serve out there?
Ms. Guapola?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Representative. I can just say in general, with supportive housing, we have, for every state dollar we invest, we save $1.44. So someone said this is kind of like when you buy bubble gum, you put your dime in, you get your dime back and the piece of bubble gum. And so for different populations, different communities, different, you know, there's different returns on investment, and we can certainly get you that data.
That'd be great.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Remind members of the game we played at our very first committee meeting, the return on investment. We might have to revisit that. Again, it was a little bit helpful. Representative Bly.
I came in a little bit late. I might have missed this if you commented on it, but I'm curious to know. I know this is a vulnerable population that you're dealing with, and it may be, there may be issues with mental health or chemical dependency or abuse, and also sometimes difficulty with directions. How do you deal with that, or is there a criteria used in allowing people to stay there? If you could just enlighten me about that.
Ms. Blanz?
Madam Chair, Representative. Thank you. It is a very vulnerable population. We really use what's called a housing first model, which is our goal was really to work to screen people in rather than to screen them out, and really to give opportunity and then have expectations. So if people can be good tenants, they are allowed to stay. It is a building, no drugs or alcohol are allowed in the building, given the age of the young people that we are serving. They're all, are almost all until they get a little bit older, underage. And so we do impose that restriction. We have a 24-hour front desk that helps keep it as a safe place both for the residents as well as helping people. One of the challenges for homeless youth is mostly they've lived together and squatted. And so the feeling is usually, well, I owe 9 other people a place to sleep because that's who let me sleep last week. And so 9 other people would move in. And so having a front desk allows us to say no on behalf of that young person until we hope that they have matured through the experience, and when they move back out that they would be able to keep those boundaries so they can not lose their housing through those kinds of issues. So we do have mental health referrals, we have chemical dependency referrals, and we work with domestic violence. Many of these young people have been physically and sexually abused as children. What we do find, though, overall, is that this kind of a program attracts the young people who really are ready to make something happen in their lives. And it's what's extraordinary, actually, is that half of them come in with a high school diploma or GED, that you see young people who are sleeping on the University Avenue bus and getting off and going to high school in the morning. And so these are young people who, through no fault of their own, through the family of origin, have really not had those opportunities. And so this gives them that place to thrive. We have young people who work two jobs and go to school, and it really is extraordinary.
Thank you. Representative Bly. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to thank you very much for that. It sounds like a very good program. Having worked with vulnerable youth myself, I know that there are those that you can help, and they're already kind of themselves on a good path, but there are many who are not. And there's I'm sure you feel worry about those that you turn away as well, or that you have to say you can't stay here. But that's a difficulty. Do you make referrals to other places?
Yeah. And Madam Chair, Representative Bly, when we first started with Nicollet Square, and once again, like I shared, the waiting list, so we opened up at one of our churches in Nicollet Mall for people to apply and let all the shelters and drop-in centers. Youth Link, our partner, sees 1,800 young people who are homeless in their drop-in center every year. So we were flooded, of course, then with applications, and we literally did a lottery, and we pulled people's names out of the hat. And to realize that for the young people at Nicollet Square, getting an apartment was like winning the lottery. This was something that they could not have otherwise imagined in their life.
just to that regard, what is your, are you keeping a waiting list, or is the lottery like start over each time? Or
yeah, we Madam Chair, Representative, mm-hmm. Keep a small waiting list, but because we're working with young people who are homeless, we work mostly through the drop-in center for referrals. And I don't know if Liz can add to the overall waiting list. That's just extraordinary in our community.
Ms. Pablo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this technology will work, but we have some voices of people actually on the waiting list, and then I can talk about if this works. We can hear from them, and then...
Okay.
Hi, my name is Latasha. Hi, my name is Tiffany Alana, and I'm a sergeant. Hi, my name is Tiffany. I need an emergency shelter. I was calling to find out, do you have shelter for me and my two kids?
Hi, my name is Victoria, and I'm looking for emergency shelter.
I was calling for shelter for me, and it's four people in my family.
I'm a single father with a 14-year-old daughter looking for a place. I'm calling for emergency family shelter. I have two twins.
I'm with my client, Marianne, today, and she has six children. Five boys and one daughter, and she is going to be in need of housing.
Hi, my name is Charlie. We are faced with an eviction. I have two children. I lost a job, got laid off, so we've lost home rent and some other issues that have happened because of the loss of this job. It was a good job.
And I'm calling about emergency shelter for me and my two-and-a-half-year-old son.
My family is in emergency need of housing.
Yes, my name is Crystal. And I'm homeless. I have three children.
Hi, my name is Tasha. Can you give me a call? I'm homeless and I'm sleeping in my car.
And I currently have one child who's 10 months old.
I am seeking shelter. I'm 4.5 months pregnant.
So it's me and my 16-month-old daughter.
I have four kids and yes, I'm looking for shelter.
And it's me and my fiance and our four kids.
I have to leave this building today. Got the landlord didn't renew his license.
We were a large family of seven, but as a result of this happening, we are separating. We've let some things go, mainly each other.
And I currently have one child.
Me, my three children, and my boyfriend.
Or any type of help with the housing, like as soon as possible.
One parent, four children, all under the age of seven. If you can give me a call back at your earliest convenience, that'd be great. Thanks.
Because I can't stay here either. She just let me use the phone. Thank you. Could you please have me? Bye-bye, and have a good day.
If someone could call us back at their earliest convenience, I'd greatly appreciate it. So if you can give me a call back at your earliest convenience, I'll appreciate it. Thank you.
I hope somebody can call me back soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and have a good day.
So, Madam Chair, the reality is that we just don't have enough services across the state. We're turning lots of folks away, but I wanted to speak just a second about the continuum and where folks land on the continuum. So we talk about homeless prevention. It's on the chart. It's in MHFA's budget. Family homeless prevention, this we know it's most cost efficient to prevent homelessness before it occurs. So sometimes it costs like $600 to prevent an episode of family homelessness versus $30,000 if they're homeless for a year in shelter. If we're unable to prevent their homelessness, Emergency shelter is a good place to land. In many of our rural communities, we don't have enough shelters, and so sometimes we're able to use hotel motel vouchers, but it's woefully underfunded. We don't think shelter is the solution, but it's a good place to land for a little while. The next best thing is for some folks, especially youth, women fleeing domestic violence, there's transitional housing for folks who need two or fewer years of support. So they get a case management plan. They might be working on their GED. They might be working on fixing their credit and things after fleeing domestic violence. They can stay for up to 2 years, and that's transitional housing. If some folks need more support, longer-term support than that, because of mental health issues, chemical dependency, or all kinds of barriers that come together. And for them, we have what we call permanent supportive housing, or just it's not permanent, but it's supportive housing without that time limit. And for that, we need the Long-Term Homeless Support Services Fund helps with that. We're trying to increase the funding to the Homeless Youth Act to help with folks all along the continuum, but specific to youth needs. And then we need rental assistance when someone, both in supportive housing and just to help them bridge the gap between what their wages are and what the rents are. We need rent assistance, which comes through Minnesota Housing. And then we just need more development. We just need more affordable units all across the state. And so that's kind of the continuum we talk about. And on every stage of that continuum, there are people in need and there are not enough slots for the need. And so if we still have a minute, I thought we'd talk a little bit about the governor's budget, what it does and what it doesn't do, if that's okay.
Go right ahead.
Excellent. So I brought a little demonstration for this, if I could, to just talk briefly about what we do now as housing policy. It's about $350 million. This is what we're doing this year in the mortgage interest deduction in Minnesota. So taxes we're not collecting because someone owns a home. And there are parts of this mortgage interest deduction, of course, that we all love, supports home ownership. Many times, low-income people don't qualify because they're not itemizing their mortgage on their taxes, but that's how much we put on that. This is $28 million. This is what we put into all of the homeless services we just discussed, rental assistance, homeless prevention, supportive housing, Homeless Youth Act, and all the rest, $28 million a year. And then this is what we do for shelter, two little beans. It's $350,000 approximately for a year. So sometimes I take these beans to third graders or something and I say, hey, if you wanted to help us address homelessness and we needed to find revenue, they often tell me, what if we just took a few of these beans from this jar and put in this jar? So this brings me to the governor's budget, and there are many things to appreciate in the governor's budget. At the Coalition for the Homeless, we highly appreciate that the governor is raising revenues on some of the wealthiest Minnesotans, asking them to pay the same percentage of their income as other Minnesotans and just trying to create some revenue. We'd even though many homeless folks are kind of among the smokers and, we're good with some of those other taxes as well, as long as it's adding to the pot. But one thing the governor does that I think we could maybe look at a little bit is he says to homeowners, because you have a home, I'm going to stack these up actually because it goes right to this same pot. He's saying, let's do $700 million a year in rebates to you because you own a home. And then he's saying, for all the homeless programs, and we appreciate this investment, but it's 10 little beans. And so we're going to add these 10 little beans to this jar. And so while we appreciate it, we just think there's a little bit of a disparity here that maybe we could work on during the course of this session. And I'll turn it over to my colleague, Darielle, to talk about the things Homes for All really appreciates about what's good in the governor's budget as well.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. Denon.
So the governor's budget, the beans that Liz was showing off are $13 million worth of beans. And $10 million worth of those beans are to provide more funding to the Challenge Program. And the Challenge Program, like I was saying, it's a program that helps us build stuff. And the idea behind that extra $10 million worth of investment would be to build stuff in parts of greater Minnesota where we're seeing a lot of job growth. And there isn't enough affordable housing for employers to attract the people they need. And we've heard there are some great examples in Worthington, Thief River Falls, Roseau, Swift, Polaris, and DigiKey. Are evidently have been working with their local chambers of commerce, their cities, and others to really try to, like I said, increase the affordable housing options so that they can bring people there and so that they can grow as a business. And so we think that's great. And frankly, if we're providing those good investments in greater Minnesota, we're providing those housing opportunities that are needed, and we're also taking some pressure off of the challenge program for other parts of the state to continue doing the good work we're doing right now. There's two other initiatives which are in Liz's beans here. They are rental assistance for highly mobile families and investments in housing for ex-felons. So the rental assistance for highly mobile families, the governor imagines investing $2 million in that. Our members do a lot of work with two things in the Twin Cities. One is called the Northside Achievement Zone, and the other is called Promise Neighborhoods. And so I know a number of you here have worked with those initiatives. And those initiatives are really about school success. But one of the things that's striking is they recognize that families, kids can't succeed in school if their family's not stable. And some of the voices you heard, if you're sleeping in the back of a car or if you're sleeping in a shelter, it's really hard to learn how to read and do your homework. I think we can all imagine that would be unbelievably challenging. So the idea there is to really make some smart investments so that we can ensure that those people are stably housed and kids can succeed in school. And then the last thing is actually providing some investments in housing for ex-felons. And I think we all recognize that it can be really challenging when you're coming out of the correctional system to get that stable housing so that you can kind of take care of the other parts of your life so you can get that job and other things like that. So those are sort of those are the things we really like about the investments. And that $3 million is, if you're looking on your Homes for All budget proposal, the $3 million would go towards the Housing Trust Fund. So those are those two pilots, the ones with stable kids and the ones with ex-felons. Those are under the Housing Trust Fund. And then the $10 million is the Challenge Fund. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Comments, questions from committee members, Representative Hertas and then Representative Mensa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your bean demonstration.
Yeah.
I see that they're not all the same beans. I'm a little data-driven, and I'd just like to point out that the three jars of beans represent the gross amount of interest deduction, but that's affected by the marginal tax rate. And I would assume that 15% marginal tax rate buyers are probably not homeowners. The 28 and 39% marginal tax rate homeowners are homeowners. And if you hybridize those together, you're talking about 30% cost of the interest deduction. So in fairness and representation, you should take two of those jars down, and your representation would be more accurate just with the bottom jar.
Ms. Scobla, did you want to respond?
Yeah, if I could, Madam Chair and Representative, and maybe I shouldn't have stacked them up, because what these two are is the tax rebate in the governor's proposal. So just the bottom one is the mortgage interest deduction. I only stacked it up because if we're looking at this group as homeowners and then this group as the homeless, and that's the only reason I put it in kind of the homeowner category. But you're exactly right. This isn't the mortgage interest deduction up there.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hertas. Representative Mensa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to give a special shout-out to one of my favorite constituents, Liz Coplin. Thank her for her hard work, not only being from a rural community. I think she brings a unique perspective, as do her colleagues, collaboratively to having a Minnesota solution rather than just a metro or a rural, and we're very appreciative of you being down here doing this work. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertas?
Yes, thank you. Just one other question. The activities of this agency has been going on, precedes most of us sitting on this committee. And I'm just curious if we have a sense of the number of units that have been built statewide and how that relates to the overall homeless population. I guess where I'm kind of going with this is, are we nearing or getting anywhere near accomplishing the goal? Are we matching a percentage of housing that is there for affordable housing for those who are in need? For example, if the need is 20% of the population, you know, are we getting close, or is this going to go on in perpetuity where we keep growing the amount of assistance housing that's available, and are we going to keep changing the definition of the poverty level?
We'd like to take that, Representative. I mean, this is Kubala.
Thanks for the promotion. A great question. I can tell you on the homeless side, and then maybe my colleague could speak more broadly as well, but we set a priority as a state to tackle long-term homelessness several years ago because we knew that that's where the largest return on investment was, and we set a goal of 4,000 units because that's about how many were homeless back in about 2006 when we set this goal, and we've accomplished 95% of that goal. Okay. And so that's why with this year's ask, we're asking, we have to continue that because we're not all the way there. And what we've seen is more and more people are entering into the long-term homeless, because long-term homeless is if you've been homeless for a year or more. And as there's not enough other services to get people out of homelessness, more people are languishing in homelessness. But it is true that when we invest strategically and wisely and look at those return on investment and how to leverage other resources, it is working. We realize we have to also shift to families and youth, which we haven't been targeting those resources. And so we think that if we do that, we can save these state resources. Even for the families with minimal barriers, that's where the $1.44 return is for every dollar we invest. And for others, the return on investment is way, way bigger. So we did hit a little bit of a snag with the foreclosure crisis and recession, as you might imagine, but some of the people who were foreclosed on became renters, and so that really tightened up the rental market and pushed more people into homelessness. But we are making significant progress, and I'd be happy to provide more data and numbers on that. And I don't know if Daria wants to speak to the rental market.
Ms. Dannon?
Madam Chair, members, I think one of the most striking statistics about the rental market is, and I think Ms. Blonds might have mentioned this, is that over 50% of renters in Minnesota are unable to afford their housing. And what that means is that they're paying more than the United States government says they should be in housing. And what happens then is then they can't spend that money on other things like food and clothing and education. We haven't changed that definition. We actually revised it up. So once upon a time, the U.S. government said you should spend 28% of your income on housing. Now they say 30 is fine. So we haven't changed that. What's happened is, as Ms. Blonds mentioned, rents have gone up and incomes have gone down. I can't speak actually to the overall number of the units that we've built in Minnesota. I think Minnesota Housing is probably a better agency to explain that. We do kind of track how many our members build, and that's mostly in the metro area, and it's over the last 10 years they've built over 10,000 units of affordable housing. That ranges, though. That's home ownership opportunities, that's workforce housing, that's housing for those who have been long-term homeless. So it's quite a range.
Okay. And just to Representative Hartus, we will have the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and from time to time they'll be back, and maybe next week they'll be back and can take that kind of question too. See Representative Moran and then Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you all for coming in today and presenting and for all the work, hard work you do to stabilize families. And so in just listening to your presentation and knowing that one of the growing population of homelessness is among youth, and the impact that homelessness have on our criminal justice system, you know, it can definitely be a burden to our educational system. And so to me, it's just really a good investment when we begin to stabilize families and the outcomes of how it is really a savings to the state and how we do our work here. Do you have any statistics on any of that?
Ms. Dana?
Madam Chair, Representative, there was a study done at the University of Minnesota that just really looked at children who have stable housing and how housing stability affects their school performance, and they found a correlation there. I think the Promise Neighborhoods and the NAS, both of those get funding from the federal government, among other areas, and I think it's very striking that they've invested in stable housing as one of the ways that they can help students succeed through both of those programs. But I'll let my colleague correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know that we have any other more deep data. But I do know that when we talked with the commissioner on sort of their initiative with that $2 million, they were very interested in making sure to study that with the idea of it being sort of a pilot. And I'm sure they'll come and talk about that more, but then they'll be able to give us a little bit more data about sort of what those rates are.
Ms. Coppola?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, I would just add to that we don't have a lot of information on, you know, the long-term cost savings, but what we do have a ton of data on, and I'd be happy to get to the committee, is the long-term health impacts on these children and on their school performance. We have lots of data on that, on how this being highly mobile, trying to do homework when you're staying in a shelter, or in rural areas in a car, you know, and what that impact is. There's been lots of data on that. And then the legislature passed a group called the Visible Child Working Group, which was a mix of advocates and legislators that studied the impacts on children 0 to 3. And so we also have some of that data that we'd be happy to share. But quantifying that, translating that to dollar saved is, there's still work being done on that.
Thank you. And that was a part of Visible Child Work Group.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then her does.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? Okay. I did remember that the presentation, again, in our first meeting with the Habitat for Humanity, they actually did talk about the return on investment and some more long-term description. So we might have to pull those cards out again and just talk about that again, because it really is a really important question. What are we saving? And again, we have the silos in state government, you know, in the different committees, but still it's our job to try to integrate those and try to figure out, you know, what we are saving where and so on. Okay, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is going to sound more like a statement than a question, but I first of all, I have to stick up for those three bottles of beans there, because you're kind of contradicting yourself when you say you want to get people into houses, but after they get there, then you want to make sure that you can take the money back in taxes from them. I will say that those people that are getting those mortgage deductions are, in most cases, two working parents trying to pay for their kids to go to school. They're not only paying their own mortgage, they're paying their own heat, they're paying their own telephone, and all the other amenities that come with the repairs of that house. And they are also paying the taxes that allow you to help the people that need help. So be careful on beating up on them. And also, I hope you're not taking those beans to school and informing children that if they succeed and own a home one day, they're going to be these evil beans in a jar. But back to the questions, I would really like the numbers that the other representatives are talking about too. And I won't go through them all because there was a few there. But if you could get us the information that you talked about, I'd really appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Bonds, do you have
Madam Chair, Representative, and not to step into some of that territory, I just want to share as a nonprofit developer of rental housing that we do pay property taxes on our rental housing that we develop. We are I'm grateful that we get what's called the 4D tax rate, which allows us to pay taxes at lower rates than the high market rental housing, but it does mean that our property taxes are approximately the same as homesteaded properties. And so just to make sure that people know that we're also contributing toward the revenue side of our communities.
Thank you. See, I have Representatives Hurtas, Mensah, Anderson, and Isaacson. So, and then I think we'll try to have our last witnesses after we get through those questions.
Thank you. Another question. With about half of the state's population in the metro area here, just curious if you know off the top of your head what your distribution of resources has been to Greater Minnesota to handle these needs versus metro.
Ms. Coppola?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I don't know about the distribution of resources from the state, but what I can speak to just briefly is the distribution of homelessness. And so we know that about one-third of the folks in the state who are homeless are in rural areas, and we also think that's probably a very undercount, because the only way we can find them is if we can go out and, you know, like, the only way to count them is to go out and find them. And so, and we don't have enough resources in greater Minnesota, and with the territory, you know, the landscape so vast, it's hard to find folks. So I'll just say that's what I know about the homeless, that there's about a third are in greater Minnesota that we're able to find. And do you want to speak to the agency's budget?
Ms. Dan?
Madam Chair, members, I don't want to talk for the agency, but and I don't happen to have it with me, but I know last year when we were talking about bonding dollars, we were carrying around maps of the state of Minnesota with sort of where the agency has allocated resources, and they're very deliberate about making sure that they're allocating resources across the state. One of the things that they do is they look at these top growth communities, and that's not just the metro. Those are some of the communities I listed. Those are, you probably know what they are, like Worthington, where there's a vacancy rate of almost 0%, and they look at those areas and they make sure that they're allocating resources to those areas as well as the metro area. And so when I looked at the map, I know that it was that they were very deliberate in making sure that, I think it was approximately half of the resources went to metro and then the other half went to greater Minnesota. But like I said, I think they're coming to address the committee next week.
Yes.
Yeah, so yes. They'll be better able to address that.
Okay. Let's try to get through the questions. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Green, I don't think I've ever met an evil being. But my real question is, what percent of the homeless are taxpayers? And I know that we're going to have different categories to that. We've got employed homeless people, underemployed homeless people, and unemployed homeless people. And if you don't have the data today, that's fine. But
let's go, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair and favorite representative. I'll have to get you the breakdown, but I can tell you that 100% of homeless folks are taxpayers because, I mean, they buy things with limited resources, and, you know, in some ways they are paying taxes. For the folks who are working, they're obviously paying taxes. What we know is the homeless population, there isn't, like, a separate population that's homeless. Most folks who are homeless were homeless before the economy tanked for 6 months or less. This is like a issue. People, they run into crisis. They might lose their job. They're unable to make the mortgage or unable to make the rent. And then they're temporarily homeless. And so during the whole rest of their careers, lives, you know, they're paying taxes and that kind of thing. But I'll get you a snapshot. While the Research Center has done lots of great research asking individuals about kind of lots of different aspects of their lives. And I think we can look into that.
Thank you. Could I do a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Sure, go right ahead.
That was kind of, I wanted the record to show that, you know, many of these people are using this for a very short period of time and then go on, and I guess in their lifetime pay back, if they're employed, many of the programs that they're taking advantage of in a short-term basis.
Thank you. And those numbers, I think, are available. We've had them for some other programs, too, so it might be helpful for this committee to know just how that works. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My question originally was answered. I was going to ask about if the nonprofit housing was subject to real estate taxes, and you said it was. And that led to another question pertaining to the renter's credit or refund. Then, you said there's a different rate for nonprofits to pay taxes. Are there different rates as far as the renter's credit goes also?
Who's answering that question? Ms. Dannon.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, my organization sometimes works on the renter's credit. It's not, I don't assume that it's something that's going to come up in this committee, but the renter's credit is based on your landlord pays property taxes, and then the state has a calculation that's based partially on income and partially on just a percentage, and that percentage has varied. It's been, I think, all the way up to 18 or 19%, and we reduced it down to I think 15 or 14% in the last couple of years. I think Representative Clark knows.
I think it's more like 17, isn't it?
17%.
Yeah. It's been whacked at a number of times. that's correct.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, if that was clear, so if we pay lower taxes, the renter's credit is lower also. So it does take into account the fact that lower taxes were paid originally.
Okay. All right, thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Say, I feel the need I feel compelled to clear up the intent of the bean. I feel like this is an important thing to clear up,
I think that
bean has been vilified. I want to be clear that nowhere in the way I received your testimony do we see that the three jars of beans were in anywhere inherently bad, or that there was some sort of contrast going on in terms of the haves and the have-nots. I think it's a comparison of what we are doing and what we could be doing. And that's what I think is important to understand. It's a philosophical comparison. I didn't get the sense that when you're in the schools, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're letting them know that the evil beans, as were portrayed, in some way represented a financial problem or result of where you could be if you work hard. And so for me, you know, coming down to the bottom line, tongue-in-cheek aside, if we really want to care about homeowners in the middle class, making sure that those among us that are quote-unquote falling to the cracks get reintegrated into society is the best way to save them money, in my mind, because when those folks are reengaged, it costs the taxpayer at the end of the day less money if we prevent versus trying to cure the problem. And so for me, even though I want to make sure we're protecting that middle class and all three of those bean jars we're talking about, I think the long-term solution is to make sure that we have less things costing us money in the first place. And that's what this homeless shelter, especially with young people, does, is it provides us a long-term solution up front rather than trying to cure it on the back end, which, as we all know, in almost any model of solving problems, is the worst and most expensive way to do so. And so I really applaud the work that you're doing, and I look forward to seeing more of you folks, and I really appreciate your testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. Okay, Representative O'Neill, can you make it short?
Very short. Okay. I just have a small ask.
Sure.
I wanted to, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask if you could provide us information about homelessness services and homelessness rates by district or by county. I used to serve on our Buffalo Food Shelf board, and I was the co-chair of the food shelf and treasurer, and on and on and on. So I was intimately aware of my own community, but I was also intimately aware of the lack of resources and the lack of support. So I'm wondering if you could provide that. It would be, if you could do it for each, I mean, that would be wonderful, but especially greater Minnesota, I recognize that is a difficult bean to count, so to speak. I appreciate your bean analogy. But if you could provide that, that would really be of great help to me. Even though I was, you know, intimately aware of my community, I still am not sure exactly where the resources are, and maybe the answer is there are none, because I know our former director was very interested in starting a shelter. I know that there is maybe no shelter in Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake area. But if you could provide that, that'd be of great help to us, especially with constituent services, as we all do that.
Thank you. And let me just say one thing. You know, I grew up in Greater Minnesota, and I've also been in the legislature long enough to know that in some of those communities where they do not have the resources, their homeless program was to give them a bus ticket to Minneapolis or St. Paul. That was the program, and they were unabashedly telling us that, you know, because they had no resources. So just sharing that with folks. Representative Hurtup, to my comment?
Just a quick comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Isaacson, very well stated, and I couldn't concur with you more, and that's the worthy goal of what we should be doing.
Thank you, members. And, you know, we're going to get a chance to go through this more. This is a nice, lively conversation. I really appreciate everybody's input on it. I do want to ask a question. So when I was coming on the way in, I talked with folks from Minnesota Housing Partnership. Were they one of your witnesses that you wanted to have today, Bill Vanderwall?
It's fine.
Can we put you until next week then? Okay. I'm sorry about that, but I do want to hear from you, because you were going to talk about Greater Minnesota, and it's certainly to the point here. So if that's okay with you. All right. I wasn't sure if you you said something about a developer or something that you might want to talk with, so I wasn't sure. All right. Then we do want to have the last. Thank you very much for your testimony and everything that you're doing. We do have on our schedule then overview of housing initiatives within the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And Kathy Vitalis, I believe, and whoever else you want to bring down, please.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll just identify yourself and...
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Kathleen Vitalis, CEO of Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. And with me today, and I believe you have to identify yourself.
Nathaniel Saltz, Program Director with Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans.
Nathaniel
Saltz, S-A-L-T-Z.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair and Committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm usually on the veterans side of the House, and however, I have some housing that I was asked to give you an update on, veterans housing specifically. So to frame that, and I am very aware of the time that we have, I want to frame what MACV does so that you understand what we do as an organization and then how that housing fits into that organization. No. So I'll just speak while they're looking. The pictures are a lot better than me speaking, but I'll try to have you see it in your minds. So MACV is a 23-year-old nonprofit. We're statewide in Minnesota, and we exclusively serve veterans, honorably discharged veterans and their families who are homeless or having some other sort of life crises. We do this by covering three different areas of gaps that are out there, which are housing, employment, and legal assistance. And I have three offices in the metro area, in Mankato and Duluth. And we outreach through all those three offices to all 87 counties. Much of the testimony that I just heard about homeless applies to veterans as well, of course. And we see everything and have worked on all of these issues throughout the state. The lion's share of what we do is preventative and also providing rent, direct legal assistance, utility assistance to those to prevent homelessness or to get them out of homelessness by virtue of grants into housing that is in the areas. But we also, because of our mission, own and operate our own housing. And that's what I was, I think, asked to come here today to talk about. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, we have gotten one of our grants through the state for almost 20 years, I think. One of our funds that helps us with this assistance to homeless veterans, and that comes through the Department of Veterans Affairs. This housing that I'll be telling you about, is not part of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. That was housing, and I'll say this many times, I am not a housing developer. And people said, well, then why did you develop housing? Because at the time, there was me to do it. And so these projects that you're going to see, again, I'm not out there trying to get some of this on an ongoing basis as a housing developer, but we did put together two of these projects that involved Minnesota housing money and some of the stuff that ends up being permanent supportive housing for veterans. It's up. So now we can go quickly. This is much better. I think you'll like the pictures a lot better than me going, how am I going to describe this? So our mission, again, statewide, homeless and in crisis veterans and their families. Established in 1990, I talked about our offices. We are a 501c3 audited annually, and I have about 75 different programs that we, and I'll talk about our funding streams. This is how we divide the state with our three regional offices so that they don't, you know, we actually assign counties to them. The VA, I don't know if many of you or any of you are veterans, but I wanted to put this slide up. We do not duplicate any services or benefits already available to veterans. That is very important to know. The VA federally looks at benefits in the terms of health care, research, disabilities, pensions, home loan guarantees, and then, of course, the National Cemetery Memorial Affairs. So the gaps I talk about are partners. Are both the federal and the state VA. We can't do this without them, but there are gaps in what can be provided. There we go. This is just for you. I thought it would be a nice picture how the federal VA looks at this area of the world, and we're in VISN 23. Now, in the state, you know you have a VA in St. Cloud, which is the only inpatient treatment for substance abuse, and the VA in Minneapolis. But they also look at veterans with some of our federal programs in this catchment area, and many of veterans in this catchment area end up in St. Cloud or Minneapolis, and then residents of Minnesota because they're getting those services here. I'm going through some of this more quickly as I have less time. National statistics on homelessness, veterans. I'm trying to just, 67,000 homeless veterans on any given night. Why we do what we do, it comes down into Minnesota.
I just wanted to interrupt you. You have until 2, so don't feel like you have to rush in 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
We'll want some time for questions. Time for questions, but I want you to get your points across.
Okay. Our organization, one of the key things I think, and I've been with it for 12 years and it's 23 years old. When I say hope is not a strategy, our philosophy is, and we're very strong, we won't, and you've heard it before, you cannot work harder than they're willing to work themselves. But for the ones that are out there willing to do that, we like to be able to help them, especially with veterans and a different set of issues that they have. We love to be able to be doing what we do on the ground. An overview of our programs, again, I am now getting, and I know you want to look at the housing aspect, but there's much more that MACV does besides just this direct housing. I talked about the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the County Veterans Service Officers. Again, key partners of ours. We do not duplicate any of the programs offered by either of these entities. They come to us and we fill gaps. We can leverage federal funding and grants coming in to help these veterans that they don't have access to. So it's a great relationship. Our funding sources come very minor, but some program fees from some of our participants, federal grants, the state grants I mentioned. We get on the federal side a Department of Labor homeless veteran reintegration program grant that we've had for both in the urban area and now rurally in Duluth. And that is a wonderful program that gives us employment resources for homeless veterans. We also have the new VA. Some of you might have heard about the SSVF grant, Supportive Services and Veterans and Their Families, another piece that addresses some of these issues that we implement statewide. And then donations and a lot of foundation support. And I wanted to just put this up there. The foundations in Minnesota, we do get a lot of our money, as many nonprofits, from the, especially with veterans, from government grants. But we have been extremely successful in working with the foundations in Minnesota and corporations and individual community foundations in support of our veterans. So that's how we piece our budget together. Eligibility for services, look at it this way, if you're not, it's an honorable discharge, 181 days active duty service. That is the state definition of a veteran. Minnesota resident. We do have federal programs, but in Minnesota, we want to make sure that they're a Minnesota resident and they're going to stay in Minnesota, and Minnesota is their home. We assess a variety of things. This is very common with anybody doing this sort of level of case management, and we provide a variety of things covering that from utility, all coming from different sorts of grants that we piece together. I must also tell you, as you're all from different areas of the state, we have very regional money. We will get money from the Blandin Foundation for Itasca County. We will get money in central Minnesota that we will use on veterans in that area, and I try to piece that together as well. And desired outcomes for our veterans. Housing. I wanted to get to this so you can see. Transitional housing, this is not state money. I will show you the two projects in a second, but it is housing that we provide. We rent and operate a 13-bed residential facility for homeless veterans through a federal grant called Building 47 on the Minneapolis VA campus. We also do structured independent living transitional housing. We have Many of these homes in South Minneapolis, Richfield, we have one in St. Cloud, Maplewood, Duluth, and our newest one in St. Paul for women veterans. I have acquired these homes over the years in a variety of ways. The majority of them were through a VA program a long time ago. I then have to find grants to own to operate them. The home in St. Paul was a wonderful collaboration from the, when you're looking at how can we get this job done. Sometimes we just need to work together on what we're doing. The House of Charity is a nonprofit. They had a home that did not fit their mission anymore, and they didn't know what to do with it. They approached us, and they donated it to us. We went to foundations, St. Paul Foundation, rebuilding together, and got the rehab money to put this home together that is now a home for women veterans in St. Paul, or a woman veteran and her children. So sometimes as nonprofits, we can figure these things out too if there's underutilized resources. This is the home in St. Paul. Now I'm just putting pictures up. These are some of our homes. They're scattered site, residential, and we use them for single male adult and then our home for women veterans. Transitional housing up to 2 years. Piece of the continuum we find extremely important in housing. Maplewood House, I have to stop here. Ramsey County came forward a couple years ago and worked with us on the Neighborhood Stabilization Plan dollars, and we were able to get this home for a 7-bedroom for single male adults in Ramsey County in Maplewood that we now utilize. It was a wonderful program and a wonderful relationship. And our home in St. Cloud. Now I want to talk about the two housing projects I believe you're interested in, I would assume. What did Minnesota Housing have to do with money for veterans housing in the state of Minnesota? So in Duluth, well, we have one structured independent living home. Again, a youth organization in Duluth couldn't operate this home anymore, and it was transferred to us, along with its myriad of obligations with HUD and everything else that we were doing. But we are now using this home for homeless veterans in Duluth. Duluth Veterans Place, Ramsey Neighborhood, West Duluth. One Roof Community Housing was our developer. 5 units of transitional housing, 11 units of permanent, and our Duluth office co-located. This is what it looked like. The city of Duluth came to us in this neighborhood. This was the last piece of property that needed to be upgraded in this neighborhood. So we looked at the 2 buildings and the lot in between, 3 different properties. This is why I'm not a developer. I went and did this. It's a wonderful program. But 3 different property owners, as soon as the person who owned the lot in between the buildings knew that we were interested in buying on the other side, his $5,000 lot became $45,000. So it was a negotiation to acquire these properties. And then I got this drawing, and I was promised it would look like this when it was finished. And we were, I'll show you the funding stream in a second as well, so you understand how it was pieced together. However, on my first trip up, that's what I saw. This is why I'm not a developer. This is way too much lost sleep for me. So it started to look better, and that is what it looks like today. And it is an incredible program and project for those veterans. Any of you ever are there and want to visit it, please let us know. We always love to show off our housing and our programs. Funding streams. This is where I came in. Corporation for Supportive Housing helped us initially with some of our things. Minnesota Housing, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, Home Dollars, Federal Home Loan Bank, TIF proceeds, LISC, St. Louis County, HUD Supportive Housing Program, and a variety of foundations. There's your normal stream of cast of characters that we had. There's your normal stream of cast of characters that we had to pull together to get this housing built. I now am doing reports at the moment for each of these entities for our annual reporting. But it was still, with all of that, there were some unfunded improvements, things that people just wouldn't pay for. So we had to fundraise a gap of $100,000. You know, when you're looking at camera systems or telecommunication furniture, signage, those are things that always fall through the gaps. And we did that successfully by a tribute wall, selling tribute wall and bricks for veterans that is in the courtyard of this facility. The next housing that we have, we actually opened, Duluth Veterans Place opened end of 2011. Our first housing that we did was in Mankato, Paul and Dorothy Radical Townhomes. And you'll see again similar funding streams, not quite as complicated as Duluth Veterans Place. This provides 11 units of permanent housing for disabled veterans. It opened in the fall of 2006. For the first thing that pulled together for this is that the land was donated. And the reason it is called the Radical Townhomes, and I'll have a picture in a second, is that that is the name of the World War II veteran that donated the land so that we could do this housing on it. Again, similar list that you're probably used to looking at with housing. Blue Earth County came through with a very important gap that we needed. And then again, starting everything, Corporation for Supportive Housing with the needed research dollars up front. And just a couple of pictures as we go through. This is three individual townhomes providing 11 units. That, I'm very proud of this. Our housing, this is Secretary of the VA, Shinseki. I had always been told that the next time he was in Minnesota, they would get him to visit our housing. Well, I'm delighted if that happens, but I'm a realist, and I didn't really believe it would happen. And it did. And he came and talked to the individual veterans in this housing to see what we in Minnesota did. This was primarily our dollars that built this housing. We do have an ongoing HUD grant for supportive services, very important, and that's where the federal piece comes in. But he's talking to one of our residents. This was Paul and Dorothy Radical. These were the people that donated the land. Sadly, they have both since passed away, but he was so happy to be able to be at the grand opening. And this is Merritt. This is when people talk to me about supportive services, we had a gentleman that they have to be able to live independently in this housing. And we had a gentleman that was in a wheelchair. He has since had to move to assisted living. But because he was in this community with our services, he had three more years of being able to live independently. And this was his little kitty cat that sat on his lap. And I just, when I see things like that and visit them and you see what you've been able to accomplish, it is worth being a developer for this housing, let me tell you. These are just some of the supportive services in this committee. I'm sure you're very familiar with supportive services that are provided for different housing. We do the same sort of things with the housing that we own and operate. And I wanted to pause there. I had a couple other slides about some other just big areas that we cover for MACV that you might be interested in what we do legally, but I wanted to see if you had any questions about the housing I may or may not be answering for you.
Thank you, Ms. Vitales. Yeah, we have a couple of people who indicated they want to have a couple of questions, Representative Hartos and Representative Radinovich. Anybody else? Okay, so we'll start with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the good work that you're doing for our honored veterans. I have a comment and a question. Obviously, the housing bubble and the foreclosure market probably has created some leverage or opportunities for you to secure more affordable housing. Nothing is done more to provide more affordable housing than the bubble bust or the housing bust. But with regard to your SIL housing, as it appears you've got it scattered around the state, are you running into any obstacles with regard to permitting or zoning or conditional use permits, getting into neighborhoods? Are you finding that to be an impediment to providing housing for our veterans in established neighborhoods?
Ms. Vitales?
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. An excellent question. And no, but I believe the process that I started when I started here 12 years ago, You do not want to be the mystery project. If you are the mystery project, you're going to have issues with your neighbors. So for the project in Maplewood, everybody was looking. They knew the person that had passed on. They knew what it had been before. They saw this rehab going on. We held a community get-together. I had asked my staff to distribute flyers to the neighbor. They distributed them a little far and wide because when I got there, we had rented chairs from a church to accommodate all of the people that wanted to know what was going on. And I have found we had children coming in, all the, when you talk about what you're doing, when they can meet the individuals that are living in the home, and you are open, we have not had that issue. But I believe some of the issues arise when people don't understand what's happening in their community.
Thank you. Representative Hurtas?
And follow up on your Duluth project that showed the courtyard there. The artist rendering showed some trees. I see there were no trees and there was a gazebo. Is it still vacant of trees?
The gazebo is there, and they are trying. I think they've landscaped it a little bit, but are you, sir, offering to?
Actually, I am.
Am I looking at
If you send me an email, we'll get you a few trees.
Oh, see, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. Yes, right. We are still missing trees.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
I'm very observant, too. I was actually wondering about the green space in general and on one of your earlier, but let's keep going here. Thank you. Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd also like to say thank you for the great work that you guys are doing. My question is related to page 3 of this book that we had handed out here. So, and it shows your targeted services in you know, which conflict or, you know, sort of what segment of the last 100 years these people came from. Mm-hmm. And I can understand the demographics around the Gulf War and World War II veterans, you know, both very small segments of the population you serve. It seems that the Vietnam veterans and Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom make up a similar percentage, and then there's also a large percentage of peacetime veterans. Could you speak to, you know, perhaps, I mean, you're talking about different generations of people there, how they end up in the situation where they're, you know, reliant upon your organization, and also perhaps any unique concerns that they might have, you know, from one group to the next?
So tell us.
Madam Chair and representatives, that's a large question, so I am going to, yes, the statistics are, first I want to point something out with the statistics that have just changed last year. We are now seeing, not a surprise, a higher percentage of OIF, OEF, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans than we are Vietnam veterans, for the first time in the history of our organization, but that's not a surprise.
Right.
Yes, they do come. We have 18-year-olds that are getting services from us, and we have 92-year-olds. Typically, the type of work we do, and I'm being very general, in the elderly, if they get a hiccup, they're living so close on their Social Security, and if there is a hiccup, something, a car repair, they literally are having trouble making a utility payment or something like that, and that's where we go in to help for a month. We're not long-term. Another area, just as a segue, in rural Minnesota, utility assistance does not cover wood. So I got a request for payment across my desk that was a cord of oak delivered and stacked. And I said, that's interesting. I have to know more. And it was a World War II veteran. His wife had passed. Up until this year, he made his own wood. And he couldn't anymore physically, so he was in 50 degrees because he didn't have enough wood to heat his house. Those are the sort of gaps at that end. And then, of course, yes, you do have, and with each conflict, you have different issues. I know you've probably heard about, you know, with OIF, OEF veterans in post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury or different things that we're seeing. Those are also things then that we accommodate with the appropriate level of housing or supportive service mix that they're going to need. But does that start to?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm finished.
Okay. I noticed you have the information in the booklet about the stand-down. I've been to a couple of the stand-downs, and for the purpose of actually finding out about homeless veterans and what percentage they are in the population is one of the questions I've had whenever I've talked with people there. And are they getting some of the services? And we didn't ask our previous witnesses, but I know that they're dealing with homeless veterans too. Do you have a number, either you or Mr. Seltzer, about like what percentage of our homeless people today in Minnesota are veterans?
What I'm going to do, and I had a whole set of slides on those statistics that I took out for this presentation, I will just get you a couple slides to your committee administrator that addresses the numbers of homeless veterans nationally and in Minnesota, and it follows the national numbers very closely.
All right, thank
would
you.
That be would
yeah,
that
that's
be good?
Great. That's terrific.
And you mentioned, I'm sorry, did you have another
any
question?
Other comments or question? No. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick question asking if you are at all familiar with a place up in Sauk Center called the Eagle's Nest Healing Village. They're trying to house 35 veterans, and if there's anything that you can work together with them on to make that go better.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, I am aware of it, and we have had talks, and my regional director from the metro area has been up there and toured the site. So I know that they're working on funding streams. It's always how do you fund these things that you want to do, but as if there were housing there or services and we could be a referral point in, that's what we try to keep track of, and we have been talking with them about what they're able to provide and offered our stand-downs as places that they can come as providers to talk about their services.
Thank you.
And we're out of time, but I did want to just put for future discussion, I guess. You mentioned some of the individuals who are maybe approaching or needing to go into assisted living, and I'm not going to ask you about that right now, but I think if there's a way to talk with you or maybe get some information on that, I know that, you know, I can think of my own family, veterans who, you know, reaching into their 90s end up in the need for assisted living. And so I'm just wondering if you can, are you doing any housing that transitions into assisted living, memory care, anything like that?
What we do, Madam Chair, is that we work with referrals for things like that when we see situations or we'll help family members. And by and large, for our veteran population, we work with the state Minnesota Veterans Homes and the programs that they have for veterans. First would be our first referral in, and to see if that would be a place that would be available for them. They're beautiful homes. If you've not had an update on them, that might be a suggestion. And then they work, their housing people would then work. If not here, what's another option for you?
Okay. All right. Well, committee members, I'm sorry we're out of time, and I know there might be a few more questions, but we can discuss them later. And thank you. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
So much.